Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome. Thank you very much indeed for coming along to what Ben and I have just decided is an occasional series in British modern history and politics here at University College. This afternoon we're going to be talking about the Scottish referendum, what happened and what's next. We've got a very distinguished panel to talk to us about that. I'm going to introduce them just before they speak for the benefits of the two recording devices that are sat here at the front. We're hoping to make this session available to a wider audience, hence we will be recording. That means that if you wish to say anything particularly offensive, you might wish to wait till the question and answer session, unless you're after infamy, in which case feel free at any time to interrupt the speakers. The plan is that we give each of the speakers about 10 minutes to share with us their thoughts on the referendum, and then there will be plenty of time for question and answer and discussion after that. So unless anyone has any procedural queries or any offensive remarks they wish to direct in my direction before we get going, we will get going. My name is Callum Miller. I work at the Blavatnik School of Government, which is literally just above us here in the Swire Seminar Room, and I have a hinterland working in the UK civil service, most recently in the Cabinet Office, which has already led to one of the members of the panel accusing me of frustrating Scotland's ambition. We might come back to that at a later stage. Our first speaker this evening is Adam Ramsey, who is the co-editor of Our Kingdom on the website Open Democracy. Adam has previously been a full-time campaigner with People and Planet, and as many of you will know, has written widely on Scottish politics and the independence referendum. He wrote 42 reasons to support Scottish independence in 2014, so I guess, like me, you've got no doubt about where he's coming from.
Indeed. I'm Scottish, but I live in Oxford. And as such, I got a rather sort of strange perspective on the whole thing, kind of wanting to be at home, but having found myself in this little corner of the South East. And the result of that was that I always got the same questions as the one Scottish person everyone knew, and lots of them. But the first of those was, why don't you have a Scottish accent? And I often found that was quite a useful way to explain the answers to a lot of the rest of the questions, because the long answer, and there's a long version and a short one, the long answer is that in, I think, around 1604, King James VI, as we call him, gathered together the Scottish nobility on the island of Iona and made them sign a treaty, the Statutes of Iona, which, among other things, said they had to send their sons to English rather than Gaelic-speaking schools. And the Statutes of Iona was kind of the start of a process of Britishification, Anglicisation of the Scottish elite, the construction of modern Britain as we know it. The short answer is, I'm a bit posh. So the point there is, I think if we're trying to understand the Scottish referendum, then there's at least two kind of more familiar prisms I think we need to look at it through. And the first of those is the decline or the rise and fall of the British Empire. So, you know, that's a process which to an extent begins with James VI going south right after he's forced everyone to sign the Statutes of Iona, which was a conscious part of this process. And then later on, the Act of the Union 100 years later, which in many ways was about that British elite coming together so they can better conquer the world. And of course, as we all know, they were very, very good at that for a very long time. And that empire, from sort of the middle of the first half of the 20th century, has been gradually declining. And I think if you look at the Scottish referendum through that prism, then a lot of that begins to make sense. So, you know, the British state, when you compare it to any other Western European state, isn't really in any sense a sort of average, normal government. I mean, half of the land for which the British state is responsible is in the Southern Hemisphere. Britain still is responsible for by far the biggest network of tax havens around the world, which are the enclaves of our empire. And, you know, what we did is turn our empire from a geographical empire largely into an empire of capital. We still, in a sense, are located at the centre of this empire, which is slowly dying. We've been replaced by America, by China, and, you know, we could all talk for hours about that story of global history where, you know, Britain is no longer the dominant force. And I think that, you know, if we're trying to understand the Scottish referendum, then that's the first bit of history to think of it in terms of it. You know, this is a sign of the breaking up of what was once the most mighty empire on earth in the history of humanity. And this is the second important bit of global context it's worth thinking about. And I'm off to Greece tomorrow because I thought it'd be exciting for the election. And we're likely to see on Sunday the election of the first sort of radical left government in Europe in a very, very long time. And of course, that is one expression of a whole range of frustrations which have bubbled up in hundreds of different ways all across the world since the global financial crisis. And, you know, we could talk about this again for hours. I'm sure you're all familiar with this story. We could talk about Podemos in Spain. We could talk about the massive rise of workers' struggles even in China. We could talk about, you know, the expression in America in different ways, and, you know, and so on and so on and so on. And I'm sure this is a story you're familiar with. And my experience of this, as we were saying before, my job before my current one was training student activists. So the way I saw this happening in practice was, you know, training left-wing student activists, let's be clear. And the way I saw this happening in practice was that after 2008, what happened in particularly England was that you saw things like, you know, UK UNCUT and Occupy and the student movements and this flaring up of anger, particularly after the 2010 election, which then, of course, dissipated because people had nowhere to channel it. And what happened in Scotland was a very different thing because it was right at that moment in 2011 that it became clear there's going to be this referendum. And so all that energy went in a different direction. It went into people saying, well, we have the chance to build something new. And so, of course, these people went off and they organised a whole plethora of campaigns and they expressed themselves in a whole range of ways. So they were talking about the Radical Independence Conference, which, you know, a few months ago got 3,000 radical leftists together, which is, you know, a bigger gathering than, you know, comparatively than you've had in England, or that kind of radical politics in a very long time, bigger gathering than the Labour Party in Scotland could manage, you know, has been able to manage for a very long time. So I think that, you know, the second way that it's important to try and understand what happened in the referendum is as just another one of those expressions of the anger that was felt after 2008 and the social movements responding to the austerity that came with it and to this, you know, rising inequality that's come from it and so on. And I think when you understand the interaction of those two things, the decline of the British Empire up against this massive, you know, collapsing global capitalism and, you know, the shaping of global capital, and then it's reasserting its dominance through global austerity, the whole phenomenon makes a lot more sense. It's not surprising that was a movement able to mobilise 45% of the vote in the end, you know, among a huge portion of the population. It's not surprising when you again think about the familiar stories around the change in the media and social media and the internet destroying, you know, very much changing the way people get information, that this is a movement which led to mass education of people, you know, a huge self-education, a replacement in a sense of much of the old media with very different forms of education. We might discuss later whether, you know, how much that's a good thing. Obviously, a lot of these things are very problematic. People believe total nonsense often. People who, like me, voted yes believe a lot of total nonsense, partly as a result of that. But I think, you know, we're trying to understand the question was what happened. And I think that, to give at least a very partial answer, understanding those two bits of global context and putting it in those contexts is at least the beginning. And the second thing I want to talk about, and I've got no idea how long I've spoken for, so do shut me up if I've got
a minute.
Cool. is going forwards. So, you know, this in a sense was, you know, at least half of that story about empire was an expression of the failure of the British state to renew itself. We haven't had a serious renewal of the constitution of the British state since mass suffrage in the, you know, the 1920s. And so, since universal suffrage. And so, if the British state is to survive, if we're not going to have another referendum, I don't mind having another referendum, but, you know, for those of you who might want to keep it together, it's going to have to utterly renew itself. And that means, you know, where Labour are promising a constitutional convention, if it is a Labour government, they're going to have a very serious constitutional convention, which really does renew the British state and doesn't just push this off into a corner. We're going to have to see, you know, very deep cleansing, you know, an understanding that we are a collection of rocks in the North Atlantic, not the great empire in the world anymore. And once we ask ourselves that question and we look at how we should govern ourselves in the modern world in that light, I think we have a chance of Britain running itself in a sensible way. And if we don't, I think we're going to see another referendum in the next 20 years or so, and Scotland will probably vote yes. And that's my time, so thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to praise you for responding so well to the minute's hint and assume that all the other speakers will do just as well after you. I'd like to introduce now Ben Jackson, who will be familiar to many of you as Associate Professor of Modern History at Oxford University and Fellow in History here at University College. Ben focuses on modern British history and has recently co-edited Making Thatcher's Britain, which was published in 2012. He's currently looking at the history of the free market right and history and politics of Scottish nationalism. Ben.
Thank you very much. Okay, so I'm going to say something about the historical context of the referendum in a way that I think complements what Adam has just been saying. But I wanted to start with a kind of contemporary observation. I guess like many of you here, I've been reading avidly a lot of the post-referendum write-ups about what happened when during the referendum campaign, including the interesting stuff that my distinguished fellow panellists have been writing. And I was particularly struck by one point that was made in, there was a kind of long two-part inside story of the referendum campaign that was printed in The Guardian that some of you may have read. And there was one thing that came out of that I thought was very interesting, which is, according to The Guardian, the public opinion research that was undertaken by Better Together prior to the referendum campaign revealed that about 30% of the Scottish electorate were definitely going to vote yes, 40% definitely no, leaving 30% up for grabs during the campaign. And according to The Guardian, when Better Together then did further research that dug down into that 30% and what kind of argument was likely to sway them one way or the other, the thing they found was that 30% were completely unmoved by appeals to Britishness or a kind of wider sense of British solidarity. And The Guardian piece has, I think, quite a telling quote from Andrew Cooper, who was the pollster who conducted that research for Better Together. And Cooper said that Better Together essentially gave up on any effort to make those kind of solidaristic arguments for Britishness because they judged it would basically be ineffective with the people they were trying to appeal to. And this is the quote from Cooper in The Guardian is, this was a very sobering statement of how much, below the surface, over the previous 10 years, the centre of gravity of Scottish public opinion had shifted in favour of the idea of independence. And so instead, I mean, in a way this makes much more kind of comprehensible the Better Together strategy, which received a lot of criticism during the campaign for being very narrowly focused on the kind of pragmatic risks associated with independence. But obviously Better Together were structuring their campaign on the basis of this public opinion research. They thought that was the only plausible route open to them. So, I mean, if you have 30% of the Scottish electorate are definitely going to vote yes, and 30% who are up for grabs but not that interested in arguments about kind of Britishness or feeling part of Britain, then that, if we believe those figures, leaves 60% of the Scottish electorate rather unmoved by appeals to British identity. And I think the referendum campaign, the results suggest to me that there is certainly something in what Cooper says and what that public opinion research has found out. And so for the rest of my time, I just want to say something sort of historical about why that movement in opinion has occurred and go a bit beyond the 10-year horizon. I won't quite be going back to the 17th century as Adam did, but go a bit beyond the 10-year horizon that Andrew Cooper mentioned about. Now, to give a full answer would be very long and complicated, but I'm just going to focus on one important aspect of growth in support for Scottish independence, and that is the association of the cause of Scottish independence with the politics of the left. I think that has been a key element in securing support for independence, particularly securing support for the cause in working class communities that have traditionally supported the Labour Party. And although we don't, I think, yet have a kind of full psychological analysis of the referendum campaign, there is one indicative statistic of that John Curtis, the sophologist, dug up, which is that he says that looking at local council returns for the referendum, in those areas with relatively high unemployment, yes support averaged about 51%. In those council areas with relatively low levels of unemployment, yes support was about 39%. So I think that is a kind of indicative of the class gradient in support for yes and no. So the question is, how did that come about? How did independence become associated with the politics of the left? Well, again, that would be a very long, complicated question to answer. But one place to start would be a pamphlet published in 1981 by Stephen Maxwell, one of the most prominent and most rigorous of the Scottish National Party's intellectuals. His pamphlet was entitled The Case for Left-Wing Nationalism. And it was issued by the 79 group of the SNP, which was the group bidding at that time to push the SNP in a more left-wing direction, and among whose number was the young Alex Salmond. Now, in that pamphlet, Maxwell argued that Scottish history lacked the grievances that were necessary to generate a form of kind of 19th-century style cultural nationalism. He said that Scotland's political union with the rest of Britain had been the result of bargaining between two national elites rather than coercion, while the subsequent economic benefits of the British imperial project that Adam already alluded to provided few clear-cut examples of anti-Scottish oppression. So this absence of despotism in the relations between England and Scotland, Maxwell said, meant that a different sort of Scottish nationalism would need to be constructed, one that sought to challenge the late 20th century social and economic grievances felt by the Scottish working class into a critique of the British state and a faith in the possibilities that would be opened up by a Scottish state committed to socialism. So in other words, according to Maxwell, the future of the SNP was to align the agenda of independence with the agenda of social and economic reform that had traditionally been associated with the Labour Party. And we might, roughly speaking, see that as the kind of strategy that was pursued by the SNP under Alex Salmond's leadership. Now, of course, it's one thing to make those kind of programmatic announcements. It's another for them to gain any kind of purchase on political reality. And for a long time, those kind of pronouncements by Maxwell seemed sort of wishful thinking rather than anything that might have kind of concrete political reality. But I think we can now see in retrospect that history did deliver the conditions that were needed to generate a left nationalist discourse with quite a wide resonance. And I think it's only really been come clear over the last few years. The trajectory of Scottish and British politics since the 1980s has cumulatively furnished Scottish nationalists with quite a promising context in which to prosecute their case. So one indication of that is that during the campaign for Scottish Home Rule during the 1980s and 1990s, there was a kind of quasi-nationalist rhetoric that was popularised that extended far beyond the confines of the SNP, and a key element of this rhetoric was the claim that Scotland possessed a distinctive communitarian political culture that was at odds with the individualist agenda being pursued from Westminster under the Conservative Party. And a further more radical argument emerged from that discourse after the 87 and 92 general elections, which was that the Conservatives in fact had no mandate to govern Scotland because their electoral performance in Scotland was so weak. So that was a view that became very popular among the elements in Scottish society that coalesced around demands for greater Scottish self-government and included many people in the Scottish Labour Party. And initially that style of argument could be used to argue for devolution, but in the longer run it was clearly capable of reaching a more full-throated nationalist conclusion, namely that if push comes to shove, Scotland can only be legitimately governed in accordance with the wishes of the Scottish rather than the British electorate. Now, that conclusion wasn't massively relevant during the long years of Labour rule after 1997, but I think the new Labour years did feed the growth of a kind of left-wing case for independence in one respect, because the self-conscious presentation of new Labour as offering something different from earlier Labour governments, something less radical, created an opening to dismiss the Blair and Brown governments as, in essence, the continuation of Thatcherism. So the claim that there was a kind of essential ideological homogeneity between the two major parties of the British state helped to kind of nurture the notion that ending rule from London would disentangle Scotland from neoliberalism. So I think undoubtedly New Labour's partisans have to bear some of the responsibility for the persuasiveness of that proposition to a section of Labour voters. The provocative definition of New Labour as opposed to Labour's own traditions demoralised traditional Labour support as well as winning over swing voters. And it then follows from that the kind of ejection of Labour from office in 2010, followed by the SNP victory at Holyrood in 2011, created almost ideal conditions for a kind of left nationalist case to gain a wider hearing. If you have an independence referendum that's happening while a Conservative-dominated Westminster government is implementing economic austerity, as Adam also alluded to, that inevitably places advocates of the union on the back foot. So as a result of Thatcherism and what you might think of as a kind of continuity Thatcherism that's happening under the current coalition government, the Conservative Party lacks any political legitimacy in Scotland. But the failure of Labour when in office after 1997 to repair the great social inequality created by Thatcherism can also be brandished by advocates of independence as evidence that as far as the British party system is concerned, there isn't an alternative to neoliberal orthodoxy. So you could say a lot more about that, and I'm sure we will in the discussion, but I just want to conclude by drawing attention to one implication of what I've said that I think hasn't received enough attention in the kind of post-referendum commentary. So the predictable formation of a sort of circular firing squad by the Labour Party has attracted a lot of attention after the referendum and has fascinated a lot of commentators. But it does interest me that there's been much less discussion about the Conservatives and the position of the Conservative Party. After 1945, the legitimacy of the British state in Scotland was really underpinned by the state's commitment to provide full employment and social welfare. And that key element of Britishness was removed, or at least attenuated, by the Conservatives during the 1980s. But I think after the referendum, as far as I can see, there's been very little questioning or reflection from the Conservatives about how they have found themselves as the unionist party that is kind of toxic for the union. And I think the lack of serious engagement with that issue on the part of Conservatives mean that essentially any time the Conservatives are in government, whether it's going to be after 2015, in 2020 or whenever, I think it's likely that there are going to be circumstances that will conspire to bring this issue back to the boil again. So in a way, what I'm trying to say is we don't so much need a kind of new case for the union or a sort of new Conservative case for the union as a sort of rethinking of the liberal market philosophy that structures contemporary Conservative, particularly Conservative statecraft and policy, but I'm not optimistic that we're going to get that. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben. Seamlessly taken from Stephen Maxwell. As I say, seamlessly taking us from Stephen Maxwell in 1981 to Conservative strategy for the next election. We're now going to move to David Torrance, who, as many of you know, is a writer and journalist in Scotland, writing regularly for The Herald, but has also written books like Ben on Thatcherism, but also on the prospects of federalism and a biography of Alex Salmond. I believe he's currently working on a biography of Nicola Sturgeon. Whether that's going to be called simply the sequel, you'll be able to tell us. David, over to you.
I'm, like Jerry, I'm very interested in the sort of constructs. I don't mean to steal your thunder on this. Sort of constructing narratives and the stories we tell ourselves in Scotland and the UK. And it's quite striking that since Referendum Day, there's a sort of official narrative emerging from the SNP and the Scottish Government that the referendum was this incredible explosion of democratic engagement, this incredible self-education, as Adam referred to it, and it was all joyous and uplifting and just bloody brilliant, you know, down to every meeting and debate. That, I'm afraid, is not how I remember it, and I can only offer, you know, a personal perspective, as we all do. Elements of it were all of those things. There's an element of truth in that. But it, at the same time, it took me about a year into the referendum, the long referendum campaign, to figure out what it reminded me of. And it was student politics, actually. It took me straight back to my undergraduate days at Aberdeen and Cardiff universities. And indeed, some of the debates then were rather more informed. You had, and this may sound glib, but a lot of sort of engagement and debate and discussion masquerading as something it really wasn't. In fact, boiled down, there was an awful lot of fantasy politics, and with all due respect to Adam, he touched upon aspects of that sort of fantasy politics agenda. And a lot of it was utterly simplistic. As I've discussed with Jerry before, there was almost no proper engagement with economic analysis or economic debate. That, you know, that was reduced to the utterly simplistic level of, you know, a yes vote is a vote to end austerity and a no vote is a vote to continue austerity, as if it was that simple. A yes vote will lead to more prosperous policy outcomes, a no vote will condemn us to, you know, some sort of terrible future. And sure, there are arguments on both sides of that, but to frame and conduct much of the debate, the majority of the debate, in such simplistic terms, to me, was not a good thing by any stretch. And it gave rise, at the end of it, to the overwhelming impression in the minds of a lot of people, including some commentators, that there exist easy solutions to deeply difficult problems. And in that sense, again, I don't think it was helpful. There was a considerable gap between much of what was posited as a potential outcome from voting for independence and what was realistically achievable. And that was a feature throughout much of the campaign. And also a gap between the official pitch, which, as Ben has touched upon, was broadly speaking left-wing, a left-wing interpretation of independence. Yet much of that was rhetorical, really, because when you drill down into the policy detail, it looked rather different. So the white paper, which was that, you know, massive illustration of Scottish government policy, when that appeared in late 2013, for the few of us who have read the thing cover to cover, and I'm one of them, a heavily annotated copy at home, also signed by both Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, which I must stick on eBay when I fall on hard times. But the white paper is actually a pretty orthodox statement of the status quo with some minor tweaks. The central sort of guiding philosophy of the white paper is that growth is the be-all and end-all, and to achieve growth, taxation, both personal and business and corporate, has to be roughly where it is at the moment, if not lower, and that once growth has been magically achieved by various means, including cutting corporation tax, we can skim off the proceeds and spend it on nice stuff like welfare, health, and being nice to everyone, which is, you know, Ben touched upon the New Labour philosophy. That was basically New Labour boiled down. I'm caricaturing its compassionate conservatism, the third way, call it what you will. It was not a fundamental break with political or ideological status quo. Yet rhetorically, it was presented as left-wing, as based around tackling inequality, you know, all about social justice. Yet if you try to find compelling ideas as to how they were going to tackle inequality or promote social justice, there wasn't very much there. On the welfare state, for example, there were two commissions teed up by Nicola Sturgeon during the referendum campaign. The first one basically described the status quo, and the second one concluded that it was all a bit difficult. And, you know, looking forward, it'd be very difficult to create a Scandinavian model, etc., etc. So, you know, very little actually emerged in concrete term. So overall, and I don't say this lightly, I think public discourse was damaged. It wasn't very strong before the referendum. I think it emerged much weaker. The word bias was redefined to mean reading something people didn't like or agree with. Facts became matters of opinion and were manipulated by both sides. And there was a long running effort during the referendum campaign by one side, it's easy to figure out, to delegitimise the UK government. So it got to the point where the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom was framed as some sort of alien interloper when he made a speech in the northern part of the country he governs. The media, particular target being the BBC and BBC Scotland, but also the print media, were delegitimised to the point that, you know, the media has many problems already, that it's much, much worse. And Adam touched upon the new media, which is replacing it, which ironically is even more blinkered and biased and poor quality than the old media. And so the outcome from that is not, as far as I can tell, a good thing. But all of this ties into the utter control the SNP has of, as I said at the start, the political narrative of the terms of debate. And so strong is that control that, you know, the day after the referendum and Alex Salmond made his well-crafted and movingly delivered resignation speech, he teed up future aspects of the post-referendum terrain. So he set up the Smith Commission, the Cross-Party Devolution Commission. He set that up to fail before it even met. He started developing the betrayal narrative, repeated yesterday, that we've been betrayed on the basis that occasionally in future the First Minister of Scotland might have to have a consultative chat with the Secretary of State for Scotland. It rather pales into comparison with, you know, oppression and grievance in other international contexts. But nevertheless, it has significant traction because the SNP control the terms of debate. And it feeds into much longer term narratives, and Gerry might speak about this, going all the way back to the 1980s, that Scotland is implicitly anti-Tory, Scotland is more left-wing, Scotland is more egalitarian, you know, Scotland rejecting Thatcher, rejecting Blair despite three landslide victories. It's not clear how that rejection manifested itself. But nevertheless, to a great degree, and Gerry's written about this very well, that is just accepted and assumed to be true by large chunks of public opinion and also opinion formers. But as we saw again and again when there were opinion surveys during the referendum, there was a significant gap between those perceptions and what your average Scot actually thinks about all manner of things. So listening to the SNP, you would believe that Scotland is one giant branch of the CND. If you drill down into the data, sure, there's a big chunk of Scots who don't like Trident, but there's a slightly bigger chunk who'd quite like it being there and don't feel particularly strongly about it being moved. But that is not what comes through. So you have what I call the great referendum paradox, and I am concluding, don't worry, I'm not going to overrun, whereby the point at which, over the past few years, Scottish public opinion has actually converged with with that in the rest of the UK. We now think more alike than people in England, Wales and Northern Ireland than ever before. The economy has also converged to a great degree over the past 30 years. You know, post-war, the Scottish economy lagged behind the rest of the UK by most measurements. But paradoxically, at the same time as all of this has been converging, electoral behaviour has been quite starkly diverging. And I think there's a good PhD thesis in there somewhere. In terms of the UK government's response, which is essentially as it's been for the past 15 years, which is ad hoc devolution, you know, here's a bit more power over such and such, now be quiet and stop banging on about independence. That strategy, I think, is subject to the law of diminishing returns. Indeed, it's already perfectly clear that there is going to be no electoral or political return on that significant investment from the UK government over the past 6 months, which echoes the Calman Commission from a few years ago, which echoes other bits of devolution and the original devolution settlement. None of it has had the intended effect. And I agree with Adam, actually. I think the only feasible response and the only one that stands any chance of success is a whole-scale recasting of the UK. And, you know, I'm born-again federalist with all the zeal of a convert. It's, of course, a minority pursuit, and some might argue a fantastical one. But only that, I think, encompassing England, crucially, the House of Lords, a written constitution, everything else, only that stands a chance of turning, of nudging that sort of middle section of public opinion, as Ben described, back towards the Union. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks, and she's our final speaker for this afternoon. Jerry Hassan is a research fellow in cultural policy at the University of the West of Scotland. He's written many books on Scottish and British politics, most recently The Strange Death of Labour Scotland, which he co-wrote with Eric Shaw and published in 2012, and Caledonia Dreaming, A Quest for a Different Scotland, which was published last year. Jerry.
Thank you very much. I so agree with nearly every single word David said there, but you might not be surprised that I'm a much more optimistic person in my take. And I'm also going to try and put this in a how I interpreted the subject was to look at into where we are now and into the future. And so I'm going to just quickly say something about the referendum. It's also quite interesting, the points David made about this strange paradoxes of Scottish conservatism and yet wrapping it in radical conceit and lack of detail. I mean, when was the last radical left programme in Scotland? I think it was probably the ILP in 1926. You know, the red paper on Scotland, Brown's great red-brown moment, there's not a single actual detailed policy proposal in it. But one of the things that was interesting, that when I wrote my book Caledonian Dreaming, here, big plug, one of the things that was missing from every single review was I was trying to explore the ambiguity of the word dreaming. That in Scotland there's a sense of dreaming and then not doing, and not acknowledging that talking social justice and then doing it. And I explored that in the book, but nobody ever, and in fact some of the elite narrative lefties like Ian Bell and so on, they clearly reviewed it, not liking it, but didn't want to say they didn't like it, and thus is Scotland, you know. So the echo chambers we live in, you know. These were very, very flawed options, the official campaigns. And I think the referendum was always really, through the bumps up and ups and downs, going to end up where it was, the result it was, a kind of Scottish not proven verdict, when one side has to argue for change and the other side, really in a way, they only have to run a default campaign and say, you know, just stick to what we know. As David said, there were several versions of yes as well within that. There was this official, very controlled yes set of messages, and then there was this a thousand flowers bloom kind of exploding that Adams mentioned. And this seemed to be practically like get your plasticine out and, you know, build your own version of a future Scotland, to the extent that Stephen Noon, SNP chief strategist and chief strategist of Yes Scotland, actually said at one point publicly, basically it's up to every individual, every person in Scotland to imagine their own version of independence, which seemed kind of, you know, social democracy as Thatcherism in a way. But Let me just quickly jump as well before I get to the main bit. The second referendum that I think we are going to have, but nothing's inevitable, just the week before Christmas, Ladbrokes odds were a referendum by 31st of December 2024 and a yes victory 6-5. Now, I actually had to explain to a couple of people, a couple of our commentators, what that meant, because they don't know anything about it. But that means broadly evens, and it's quite a good bet for independence. So, briefly, the Scottish independence referendum, it wasn't just a constitutional moment or a democratic moment. It was about society, power and voice. This is where I'm much more optimistic than David, with agreeing with nearly all his qualifications. Fintan O'Toole said in the independence referendum, ask an important question to people and they recognise its importance and people respond with a dignity and see that they have a collective power. A collective power they normally, in most modern politics, modern life, basically never experience at other points. I think that is profoundly right. I thought when the poll came and yes, we're briefly ahead, you saw that in the way people acted in Scotland. They felt we're shaking the British establishment and they enjoyed that. Didn't actually mean they're necessarily going to vote yes, but they kind of enjoyed that unusual moment. And I think that might not go away. Post-independence referendum, we see an attempted return to business as usual. So, by everyone in the sense, really, in north of the border, the narrow focus on the Constitution, the 39-day Smith Commission, we got a draft Scotland Bill suddenly produced, and we have this party political dance, as David was saying, the SNP saying betrayal, voting on English matters. And a kind of positioning about, evil, as it's called, English votes for English laws. And none of this is going to be, I think, the answer or the solution. None of it is going to find a settled will or be, in Cameron's words, built to last. And that's because the independence referendum isn't just about constitutionalism. Why we ended up where we ended up isn't an accident. This is one of the debates we have. Was it an accident or was it designed? It was a product of a changing Scottish society. Scottish society used to be, for all its myths as kind of radical and all that, it was one of the most ordered, hierarchical, controlled societies in Western Europe, a society where the church basically ruled the land until, maybe a century ago, maybe 150 years ago. And that authoritarianism was you could feel it in the air of Scotland until maybe the last 30, 40 years. And so I think the independence referendum came from that. It was a product of that. And it's then acted in unintended consequences as a catalyst of further change. This is again where I'm more optimistic. The unintended consequences, I think, of all this stuff, lots of which is right, is problem voices, problem people, superficial discussions, is that power and authority are shifting in society. People are not waiting to say, I have to have permission to do a campaign, to have a view, etc., etc. And indeed, this is part of Scotland becoming a bit like everywhere else in many ways. Everywhere else in Western Europe, and in many ways like the rest of the UK. So none of this, I think, is about constitutional kind of fine-tuning and in terms of public opinion. There's the obvious desire for economic social change, the issue of the cul-de-sac of progressive Britain, the failure of Labour Britain, or the failure of Labour Britain as it is perceived kind of in some of these narratives in Scotland. I mean, that again, that's a complicated set of issues, as David said. Labour won 3 landslide elections north of the border. They may recover in the Westminster elections coming soon. But there's this perception about the British state, the gridlock of neoliberalism, and it being coalescing around the British political class and state, which has massive truth in it, but then we kind of other that and say, we are virtuous, we don't vote Tory, we're progressive, despite the fact we are nearly as unequal in income and wealth as the rest of the UK and as England. So, there's this mismatch between action and words that we don't really talk about. So, just a couple of observations. If this isn't about narrow constitutionalism, I don't think the answer can come from things like Smith or repeated Scotland Acts and conventions and so on, even British conventions. I don't think it'll come from a kind of federal UK. I think there's little demand little public demand drive for a federal UK. I also think there's the issue of, in any kind of like remaking of the British state, the kind of unexplored area in the last 50 years of the attempt to find a different kind of British state, one that was more developmental, long-term and economic policy, and you know, breaking Treasury control, etc. You know, that discussion has been there explicitly from Macmillan, 1961-62, you know, when people looked at France and Italy then and said, oh, they're very impressive, you know, can we do things like them? The Wilson National Plan that was buried with devaluation, even Labour's first alternative economic strategy in 74-75, the recent Heseltine report that was binned, basically, sidelined by the government. That set of discussions seems to me to be sidelined in Britain. How you remake the constitutionalism with a different kind of state then linking to the economic and social seems like, you know, we are miles away from the possibilities of that in Britain. So, just some kind of concluding thoughts. The future, we are seeing, not surprisingly, you know, given where we are, the increasing territorialisation of UK politics. Jim Murphy made the great intervention where he said, you know, more Scottish nurses funded by the mansion tax. Was it 85% from London? Or was it 85%?
Yes.
Yeah, and this brought the reaction from London Labour MPs, particularly, funnily enough, all the ones positioning for the London Labour mayoral post, of saying this was scandalous, you know, Diane Abbott, David Lammy, and in a way, acting territorially, acting as champions of London.
Nationalists.
Yeah, as nationalists, crypto-nationalists, in a way that is surprising and very, very unsurprising. But I would say, where in any of this is the progressive voice? In Scotland, in London, and in the rest of the UK. So I just want to conclude with this future observation. There's an assumption north of the border, practically everywhere, including in Scottish Labour, that the future is bright. Well, maybe not to them, but the future is SNP, you know? The future is Yellow, the future is Nicola, etc., etc. Yet, this Scotland I'm talking about, that's a little bit, you know, significantly changing, less controllable. The SNP are incredibly centralising and controlling. They're rather like New Labour on a good day, you know, without the scandals, the wars and all that. And their version of independence for the last 20 years has been the narrative, the mantra of full powers of the Parliament, the sovereign Parliament. I don't want to live in a Scotland where the Parliament has full powers. I want to live in a Scotland where the Parliament has less powers. So what they're proposing is independence in an ordered hierarchical society, a new bright version of that, with them, funnily enough, at the centre of it, pulling those very important levers that politicians pull. And I think that Scotland's increasingly at odds with people's want to be, you know, a bit fuzzy, a bit messy, or, you know, maybe they're not all going to go and join National Collective or Radical Independence, I guess, you know, that's it. But they do want to have a different kind of politics and have more responsibility. And I think that tension between those two opposing versions of Scotland, which actually SNP and Labour both represent that in different degrees, is going to be one of the real fault lines in Scottish society, and one that I think is at least as important as any form of narrow constitutionalism over the near future. So, thank you.
Great, well, a big thank you to all four of our contributors for getting us off to a flying start in terms of the discussion and debate. I think all the contributors split their comments really in how on earth did we get here and where the hell are we going? And it might be useful if we sort of marshal some of the questions in that regard to get a wee bit deeper into each of those two topics, because we were offered different accounts of those two answers from the speakers. So maybe just start with the first of those. We had differing accounts, the long view back to the 17th century, more contemporary account of the failures of successive British governments from the early 80s onwards, and then some more cultural references and social change that may have contributed to how we got here. Questions relating to that theme?
Yes, please.
If you could each just introduce yourselves, say who you are, if you have an affiliation, just the speakers have some sense of to whom they're reacting, that'd be great.
Doug Stevenson, former fellow in history at Worcester College, Oxford. I've also just written a book on the history of British elections in 1689, and the question really springs from that. The thing that really strikes one, as several people have referred to, is the missing Conservatives. Why isn't there a Conservative vote in Scotland? It's obviously the issue which opens up everything else. why the SNP can rise. If you're looking at the fate of the rise of insurgent parties of different types over the last 100 years in British politics and their success. But obviously the most important thing to say about Scotland, what's its peculiarity, is the missing Conservative vote. It's there to a certain extent if you have enough proportionality. In other words, there are obviously Scottish members of the Scottish Parliament, there is a Scottish, I think, MEP. But why is it that Scotland has proved cephalogically different in the last 20 or 30 years to the rest of the United Kingdom, apart from Wales and whatnot?
Thank you very much. I'm going to take a couple more questions and then come to the panel to respond to them. And yours would like to dive in. Yes, please.
My name is Ailey McFarlane. I'm a student at Trinity College, but I was also a member of campaign staff for Better Together during the referendum. A lot of you talked about how split the Yes campaign was with lots of different visions, but my feeling was that there was also a lot of split on the No side as well. There was a lot of different visions. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of difficulty to find a coherent vision for Better Together to push, and particularly there was the problem of the parties all kind of doing their own things. As we talk about the Conservatives really piled into Better Together in a way that Labour and the Lib Dems perhaps didn't. And the fact that the parties have all got their differing opinions, how much do you think that was damaging to the No campaign?
Thanks very much. Are there any more questions in this round? If not, let's go to the panel. Who would like to take the question about Conservatives? David, you're in.
Yes. All right, yeah. Why isn't there a Conservative vote in Scotland? There is a Conservative vote in Scotland. And it comes back to my point that there's a gap between social attitudes in Scotland and electoral behaviour. So Wings Over Scotland, a fairly pungent pro-independence website, which some of you may be aware of, has been commissioning some quite interesting polling. And he did a poll last week on social attitudes comparing Scotland with England. And it was quite striking because I think when asked, is too much immigration a problem? 69% of Scots said yes, and 70% of people in England said yes. There were similarly centre-right or conservative views on welfare. There are nuances, of course, but generally speaking, there wasn't a huge gap between Scotland and England. But, as you identified, they don't vote, or most of them don't vote Conservative. So the Conservative vote is there, but it's dispersed. And one key feature of the SNP, which is completely below the radar for mystifying reasons, is that shift in a similar timescale to that of New Labour. As New Labour was, you know, learning to love free market economics, so was the SNP. And from the late 80s onwards, led by Alex Salmond, Alec Neil, and others on, you know, the sort of centre-right of the party, they fully embraced the Irish model, free market, cutting corporation tax, being business-friendly. And, you know, that is... I mean, I chaired an event with Alex Salmond during the referendum and annoyed him intensely when I described his economic views as small-c conservative, which they are. And this manifests itself again and again over the past 20 years. And there is a chunk of the SNP vote which likes that. And so there's Conservative votes there. There's a bit of the Conservative vote which, you know, now votes Lib Dem, although that's fast disappearing. And, you know, as Labour historians will know, there was always an element of conservatism there. Mm. And the main reason is because the Tory brand is toxic and remains toxic.
What made it toxic?
The Thatcher years, the rise of that dominant narrative that Scotland isn't Tory, it's anti-Tory, and the Tories were anti-Scottish, that Thatcher hated Scotland, that she tested things on Scotland, the poll tax narrative was particularly damaging. And it played to a sense of grievance and victimhood, which, you know, to be honest, has always been there in Scottish culture.
So you really would put it down to Mrs. T?
It's not that simple. If you trace it further back, the Tory vote declined most steeply in the 70s. It was in the two general elections of 74. So, ironically, Thatcher increased it. She revived the Scottish Tory vote, and even in 87, she had, you know, before the 87 election. For much of the 80s, this is a better way of putting it, for much of the 80s, Thatcher had 21 or 22 MPs in Scotland and around 30% of the vote, which wasn't that bad. I mean, it's nowhere near that now. So there's a gap. On the ladies' point about Better Together, just briefly, I think that's absolutely right. At various points in the campaign, Better Together didn't look better together because there was obvious tension, mainly between Labour and the Tories, tension exacerbated by very calculated SNP attacks. And yes, they had differing visions, but of course, crucially, the Yes side and the SNP depicted them as all the same vision. You know, they were all shades of Tory, red Tories, yellow Tories, but all Tory.
Thanks.
So, I mean, just on the Tories in history, it's worth going back a bit. So the Conservative Party, I did this before, didn't I? The Conservative Party was founded in the 1830s after the Reform Act and didn't win a single election in Scotland in the 19th century and has in fact only won five times in Scotland. And only then, there was a period when there was a party called the Unionist Party, rather like the Ulster Unionists in Northern Ireland, that they only won those elections in two circumstances. One, as the national government, in the various times that people ran as the national government. Or secondly, when they ran as a combination of the Anti Votes Together of the Unionist Party and the National Liberals, who were a split from the Liberals. So if you go into the wonky detail, there are five times the Tories have won in Scotland. People who sat on the Tory benches have won in Scotland, and they never ran as the Conservative Party. So the Conservative Party as such.
Define one, though. Do you mean the largest party or winning a majority of the vote?
Either of those. The 1900 election or 1901 was the one time that was different, I think.
Because few parties win a majority.
No, I think majority and plurality, so come first.
Sure.
Obviously not majority. And so I think you go, you know, so I don't know the answer to the question, but it's worth remembering a lot of those elections, because the Reform Acts didn't apply in the same way in Scotland. It was the Scottish elite voting and they voted Liberal. And if you look at why that is, I don't know the specific answer, but it has to lie on rural questions, because the basic difference in politics, if you look at the political map, you know, urban areas vote Labour or vote for the left in both Scotland and England. The difference is rural areas. And in Scotland, rural areas vote Liberal or SNP on the whole, and have done for a very long time. And you could talk about enclosure acts as a difference there, and the difference in crofting and enclosure in the Highlands, at least, in the crofting counties, where the people vote Liberal still because of the crofting acts of the 1870s. I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, some of them know that's why they're voting Liberal. you know, and
but just remember, in 1997, people were publishing books like Ball and Selden, The Conservative Century. Conservative Party, the most successful party, in, you know, of this century, electorally, sweeping out the middle class vote, the upper working class vote, and that seemed to be the case. You're really suggesting that didn't happen in Scotland?
Mm. Yeah, I think that, you know, lots of things happened in Scotland, and it happened a bit. You know, this idea. You know, I completely agree with the point. So the second thing I think is important about this is that it's true that Scotland isn't particularly more left-wing than England. You know, social attitudes are about the same on the whole. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a thing that's different about Scotland. In a sense, what's different is England. You know, the political class in England do not reflect the views of the populace of the country. You know, 80% of people want to renationalise railways. You know, you can do polling on any kind of left economic question, and the population is a long way to the left of the public in the UK on almost any economic question. And you know, I can talk you to you're making face there.
I'm just completely unconvinced by that. It doesn't.
36% of people think, you know, a majority of people think that austerity is the wrong strategy.
I'm not sure we can take nationalising the railways as a sort of
emblematic
of left wing.
But we can go through, you know, redistributed taxes. People are much more supportive than are any of the main parties. Yeah. You know, 36%, you know, plurality of people when asked questions about the fiscal strategy think austerity has failed, so 36% in the last poll, 20% think that austerity is unfair, but it's generally a good idea, another 20% think that it's...
You know, is Scotland intrinsically deviant or recently deviant?
But my point is, it's not Scotland... My point is that the Scottish Parliament, you know, because of devolution and different voting histories, is basically more expressive of those opinions that are also held in England than is the Westminster Parliament. And that's not, you know, that's the difference. It's not different in opinion, it's different in political system.
I do like the idea of Scotland being deviant, and I'd have to say yes, please, because given the long story we've come from of this rather ordered, you know, society, and there's in Scottish cultures, people know there's all sorts of wonderful stereotypes of that, you know, the Bruins and the Sunday Post. It's a huge part of our caricatured culture while we tell ourselves these romantic stories. Anti-Tory Scotland, as Adam was saying, you know, anti-Tory Scotland is a long, long long set of myths, and I mean myths, not dismissing them, stories in Scottish culture that have deeply back into, probably from the beginning of the Tory party, the fact that the Liberals won those elections, you know, when there was a tiny electorate, massively. They won urban Scotland, they won rural Scotland, in the way the Labour Party never did at its peak. Labour was always a party of urban Scotland and then tiny little bits of rural Scotland, and even again, not even all urban Scotland until recently. I think there is this narrative of difference in Scottish politics that is, I mean, there's this pointless debate we have, but are we different or are we not different? It's clear we are both at the same time. So we have people like John Curtis going, you know, Scottish social attitudes, look at the values, we're not that different. But yet, when you get to things like the votes at the last UK election, the gap between the Labour lead in Scotland and the Tory lead in England is the largest on record. And I think, I mean, David's alluded to this in briefly. One of the things is that the Labour Party in Scotland at its peak and the SNP at the moment are both, they've been big tent parties, and you can be, you know, you can be a radical lefty or a pretend to do that, you can be a neoliberal, you can be a social authoritarian. Some of Scotland's most successful social authoritarians sat in the Scottish Labour Party. Think of people like Willie Ross saying, you know, we'll not have decriminalisation of male homosexuality in 1916 because the Kirk won't stand for it, and nor will my Labour MPs. So they did that very successfully until the early years of the Parliament. The Scottish Labour leadership totally colluded with the Catholic Church hierarchies and so on. And I have got personal experience of, you know, various, I won't say which documents though they are because it's on a podcast, but various detailed Scottish Government documents being absolutely stripped bare of anything that might offend the Catholic Church, and people who spent years of life producing them going off in the huff, because they were often on things like, you know, moral issues like sexual health and things like that. You know, you get the drift. And just as one quick concluding thought is, one of the things we've had is this strange kind of notion of sort of like continuity independence, which is says at the same time, you know, everything's fine in Scotland if we are just kind of like run things ourselves, and at the same time also poses that kind of everything's awful in Scotland. And it actually is an ability of all successful political parties to tell contradictory messages at the same time. So thus, the SNP have been building a new establishment kind of in Scotland, as all parties eventually do, and at the same time running as an anti-establishment in the way, you know, Thatcher did, Reagan did. Now, you can't continually do that. Eventually, you know, the laws of gravity of politics reassert themselves. And I just wonder how long that is going to last before people say, look at the distributional choices you're making. And in fact, the points Adam's making, just the last quick point is, 15 years of devolution, 15 years of the Scottish Parliament, under Labour and under SNP, not one significant example of redistribution to those who are poor or most in need, but the constant mantra and pretense. How long does that go on in our politics? Because that's not a good politics.
Thanks, Jay.
Ben? Yeah, I mean, just quickly on this question of the missing Conservatives. So maybe one way of thinking about it is that if you go back to the 1970s, as people were mentioning earlier, Conservatism across Britain was in a lot of trouble in general terms. By the second election of 1974, the Conservatives had lost four of the five previous general elections, and there was a real sense that the Conservative Party itself all over Britain was in a crisis. And so what then happens is Margaret Thatcher takes over the leadership of the party and is able to kind of re-engineer and reimagine conservatism in a way that it discovers a new social base and a new kind of politics for the 1980s. And so the kind of traditional conservative social base, which looked like it was eroding and corroding by the time you get to the mid-70s, is reinvented in the kind of classic sort of Thatcherite working class mode. Now, that kind of Thatcherite reinvention doesn't work as well in Scotland as it does in the rest of the UK. And so I would attribute some of the story to the Thatcher government, in the sense that I think the Scottish Conservative Party, and more broadly the British Conservative Party, were very maladroit in the 1980s and early 1990s, and enabled themselves to be portrayed as anti-Scottish. And there is a contrast with the Scottish Labour Party that was very clever in its political positioning in the 80s and early 90s, because the Labour Party at that time was able to manoeuvre itself into the position of being the leading party of devolution, to position itself just just in an advanced enough position on the constitutional question to be able to kind of soak up support and not allow the SNP to colonise more territory. So I think it was, you know, in part, a bit large part, the failure of the Conservatives, perhaps because they didn't care, let's be frank, they weren't that interested in Scotland, that particular government, to think seriously about the way that the dynamics of Scottish politics were unfolding and to think about how they could position themselves. So in particular, had the Scottish Conservatives been interested in devolution or thought about making some moves towards serious forms of devolution,
as they once were,
had they gone down that kind of road, you could maybe imagine a kind of counterfactual scenario in which they became less of an anathema in Scottish politics. Because I think what I imagine, and I'm not a sociologist, but I imagine what then happens by the time you get to 87, 92, 97 is there's very strong anti-conservative tactical voting, as there is in other places in the UK, but it's very sort of strongly coordinated, and so that even though there is this conservative vote, it doesn't win any seats in 97.
Thanks, Ben. Alex, do you want to come in briefly, or can I go? Okay. Other questions? Yes, please.
I think some of the speakers touched a little bit on...
Sorry, can you just introduce yourself, please?
Jake Taylor King, DPhil, Mathematical Biology. So I think some of the speakers were talking about, like, if you want the union to last, then we need a kind of affirmation of... why we should be together, or some big event needs to happen. And I was wondering what kind of thing they had in mind. I mean, what, like, you moved the Houses of Parliament to Bradford or something? I mean, I don't know. I was just interested in your thoughts.
Great, thank you. Gentlemen, let's try to jump right back.
Anthony Darlington from Urban Democracy. I just wanted to ask what the rest of the panel think about David Torrance's point. He said, I mean, I went up to Scotland for the campaign, for the last 5 days of the independence campaign. They said, remind him of student politics, it was poorly informed, it public discourse was damaged, the basic arguments that were put forward were completely conventional, and therefore the myth that's arisen that this was a moment of engagement, a positive model for politics, is complete nonsense. And it just struck me that people were very, very thoughtful. I mean, people in the street, people who were being canvassed. I was with Adam, I watched people, I was sort of, I don't know when they were blowing, I wasn't canvassing, but I mean, people even when they were not, they clearly had made up their minds, they were quite concerned about the yes or no. There was very, very high turnout, a very, very determined turnout. There was a very high level of engagement, if student politics was like that, if student politics would have, you know, 94% registration and 84%, 86% turnout, well, that would be a model for everybody, even if the arguments were relatively simple. So I think I'd first like to start by asking other people on the panel whether that is your view, that this was a kind of degenerate, trivialised...
okay. Thank you. Very open question. I would take one more from this round, and then we'll get to that.
Hi, I'm Michael Muir. I'm an undergraduate and a member of the Scottish Labour Party. How do you think the Scottish Labour Party can revive itself, if it deems it can revive itself? And specifically, how can it engage with kind of working class communities in the west of Scotland, which voted yes, and it now seems we're going to lose a lot of those votes in the general election.
Yes. Right, we're going to do this in reverse order, so we're going to come to you first, Ben.
Okay, great. On Anthony's question about what was it kind of student politics or not? So I guess I'm probably a bit more sanguine or optimistic about it than David was, in the sense that I think that, I mean, it would be a hard-hearted person who, regardless of what you think about the referendum, who confronted with that at the level of sort of engagement that you reported, which I think is broadly true, the fact that there was among most people a kind of serious thinking about the constitutional fundamentals of the state that they lived in. I think it would be a hard-hearted person who kind of utterly sees that as a kind of, you know, worthless enterprise. I mean, I think there was clearly a massive and very interesting discussion went on at many levels in Scottish society during the referendum, and so I think that is positive. I mean, I think that the trouble is, and I can, in a sense, I can see where David's coming from, is that for a lot of people on the no side, I think it was a much less positive experience than for the people on the yes side. So the yes people were enjoying the kind of festival of democracy and having lots of great meetings and talking a lot. I think the no side felt a bit more under the cosh, just kind of, you know, socially and publicly, in a kind of sense that they were being kind of, you know, delegitimised or shouted down and so on. And you can talk about whether that's right or that's wrong, but I think that that perception was there. And so I think the only, the kind of note of reservation I'd enter is that the, even though I think it was, you know, great that there was this kind of fundamental constitutional discussion and there was lots of engagement, you know, I think there were undoubtedly some people who left the process, and perhaps it's inevitable with this kind of discussion, but who left the process feeling quite bruised and feeling that they hadn't quite got the kind of fair crack of the whip in terms of the discussion. On the what can the Scottish Labour Party do to revive itself, I think probably what it's doing at the moment is the best option in the locker, which is slightly positioning itself to the left, trying to exercise a degree of competence and strategic wisdom in its media profile, and trying to give an impression of a, you know, plausible kind of alternative government. I think the real question is whether there's anything that can be done that can kind of win back the support of the Labour voters who voted yes. I mean, I suppose it has to be about framing the choice of the next election as about whether you want the Conservatives in or not, which is, of course, what the SNP are now trying to counteract by saying, don't worry, if you vote for the SNP, we'll be with Ed Miliband all the way. And you don't need to worry about voting SNP for that reason. And I think that, I suppose, is where the kind of battle's going to come. But I think I didn't expect, and I think a lot of people didn't expect, the kind of activating impact that the referendum would have and the referendum discussion would have on kind of energising a section of the population in the direction of yes and in the direction of Scottish nationalism. And so the question is whether that can be, that sort of genie can be put back in the bottle, or whatever metaphor you want to use, so that you can get back to a kind of standard Westminster election then framed as being about, do you want the Conservatives in power or not, which I guess is the best option that Scottish Labour's got at this point.
Okay. Thanks, Ben. I'm going to reverse what I said about voting in last order, not because David's so impatient to get back into this question about whether it's student politics or not, because unfortunately he has to leave us in a few minutes. So David, do you want to respond to those three questions?
Yeah, what's the sort of big bold statement? I touched on that then, I think a federal recasting of the UK. I'm not a great fan of the idea of shifting Westminster or shifting the chamber north or whatever, but I mean, I suppose that may send out the right signal. But my main point is a federal rethinking of the UK. Can the Scottish Labour Party revive? I broadly agree with what Ben says. I mean, Jim Murphy is essentially trying to out-nationalists and picking a fight with his London colleagues was all to the good in that respect. And he is, you know, he's triangulating like crazy at the moment, for which he's being derided by people like Alex Salmond, who triangulated like crazy for 20 years, so he'd know all about it. So I think he's the best option they have, and that may sound like I'm damning with faint praise, and it's probably because I am. On Anthony's point, I realise that I probably did sound a bit damning and glib. I should have separated it out. I think the turnout was terrific. You know, I hope all of that. It will be interesting to see what the knock-on impact is in May, actually, and next year, because it got lost in the mix because of the SNP landslide in 2011. The turnout in that election reached 50%, which was pretty poor. And that felt similarly exciting and highly charged, but it didn't engage nearly the same number of people. And you're right, I overheard amazing conversations on trains and in pubs, and some not-so-amazing conversations. I think what I was condemning in particular was the public discourse and the level of public debate, by which I mean the statements put out by the campaigns, the TV debates in particular, and the second one in particular was not an edifying experience, I think, for anyone watching it. And a lot of the town hall meetings I went to where there was a pretty horrible atmosphere. And so I would separate that out. I didn't mean to condemn it. And you make a legitimate point that if only turnout in student elections was that high, things might be very different. But I stand by it broadly speaking.
I wasn't in a town hall meeting and people talked about these things. So you're saying, this is a really serious issue. So obviously people are engaged in all kinds of ways which, if you're trying to just be cool about it all, might have an ugly element. But you were saying really, the arguments were very trivial, which is slightly different from saying people were really...
But I think the dominant discourse was often very trivial, frankly. I stand by that. And I covered it closely for not just the 2 years, but the 3 years, from day to day and from several different angles. And that was very much my experience. And I think it's been damaging to discourse overall. But for all the reasons I give, that it's now this... People think in such starkly black and white terms on both sides, and that has been queued up and encouraged by the Scottish Government, by the UK Government, by the main political parties, and that will have long-term consequences. And we see it as the debate carries on, as it pans out after the referendum. I think it's been deeply harmful in that respect.
Okay.
And on which point I need to escape.
Thank you. Not running away from you. David, thank you very much indeed for your
That's
my chance.
On the student politics question, I was chuckling because I was involved in student politics with many of the people who were running the Better Together campaign about a decade ago. These were my rivals back then as well. I agree with David about the official tone, and I don't just mean from Better Together, from the official Yes campaign as well. The people on both sides I knew from student politics and were exactly the same as they were when they were doing student politics. These were people who I did student politics with, and they haven't changed. But I think that what's much, much more important is not what was said by the official campaigns, which I think people learned very quickly to take with massive dollop of salt. What's much, much more important is the conversations at the bus stop, the conversations that you had when you stop people in the street. Is my mum, who I talk to all the time and who seems to have done a degree in economics over the last 2 years in order to understand how she wanted to vote in the course of the referendum. And, I think she's kind of symbolic of most people in Scotland. And, people who voted both ways. There was a huge, huge public engagement, and that wasn't particularly facilitated by any of the major parties or by either of the official campaigns, who largely were, as David says, pretty awful. I think the people, and it's not because they're any different, it's because any group of people given such an enormous question will engage with it and take it very seriously and work out what they can. Just on the other question, what big changes? I think that, sure, we need, to talk about territory and things like federalism and so on are important, but my point was that this wasn't a vote about just the territory of Scotland. It was a vote also saying the way that we are run doesn't work. Britain, Oxfam say Britain will soon be the most unequal country in the Western world. That's not a coincidence. There was a report a couple of years ago saying that basically the same families with the same surnames have gone to Oxford and Cambridge universities for 1,000 years now. We have a deep problem in the British state, and it's not just about whether you're Scotland or whatever. The reason people were voting yes, or considered voting yes, even if they didn't, was it's the opportunity to build something new. And often they don't really mind if that's in Scotland or it's Britain-wide. It's not the territory that's always the opportunity. It's just a chance to escape and try something different. So I think what we need is a full constitutional convention, as has been had in various other places. I'd like to see some sort of, we published a lot about this on our website, Open Democracy, but some sort of mixture of sortition and politicians, as it did in Ireland, and being the panel to work out how we should run our country and work from there, have a proper written constitution like almost every other country on earth. What Saudi Arabia, Israel and New Zealand, maybe any other countries which don't, it's absurd. So that's the first thing. And then what we get from that convention, well, that's and to pay it for another day. And the other question is about Labour, and we could talk about this again forever, but I think there was one very, very important statistic which emerged about a month after the election, which was entirely missed, which was the SNP Trade Union Group now has more members than the Scottish Labour Party. And so they tweeted they now have 13,000 members, and that was in November. And if you consider the dynamics of Scottish politics, the extent to which the Labour Party is dependent for funding upon the trade unions and for support and for getting messages out and so on, that one fact signals a very rapid decline in the Labour Party in Scotland. And, I don't know the answer to your question. I think that, if I was coming into Scottish Labour right now, I disagree. I'd voted for Neil Findlay if I was a Labour Party member. I think they need to firm up that base and work from there. I think Jim Murphy is probably the wrong man for the job. He's, you know, he's a big fish. He's charismatic. He's never really had a serious policy idea or suggested that, you know, his most prominent policy proposal before he was involved in the referendum campaign was as Shadow Defence Secretary, where he said that veterans should get free speedy boarding onto aeroplanes. You know, the media constructed this idea that here is a big beast in politics. No, here's a former, you know, talking about student politics, here's a man who came up through NUS. That's the only route that Labour has anymore. You know, they've lost all their, they've purged all their people from the trade unions. They've only got student politics. They've lost student politics now. You know, the president of NUS Scotland is now a Green Party member, campaigned for a yes vote, as did everyone else, the NUS Scotland executive. They've lost their base. They're, you know, build from the bottom up is how you build a party. They're, if you look at the bottom, if you look at where people go into Scottish Labour politics from, they've lost it all. They've lost the unions, they've lost the student unions, they've lost civil society. You know, Oxfam used to be a revolving door for the Scottish Labour Party. It's now not at all. They're in real serious trouble. I don't know the answer to that problem.
Yes.
I think, firstly, we have to be careful about myths of the independence referendum, and there are piles of them. We have to be wary of them from the yes side. I mean, actually, even the notion of yes now is a questionable notion. You know, the fact of where are the last window posters going to be that come down, you know? Are people holding out, they held out for Christmas and the New Year? You know, is it because we just keep them for the next referendum on Europe and hope that the progressive side is on the same side. So I'm against the yes mantra, and I'm obviously critical and challenging of David's you know, contrarian cynical view. I came up with the term in the referendum that the missing Scotland, and then qualified it and so on, which is about the missing million voters, and they turned out. But what was interesting was they turned out, yet with all the myths of that, actually it was the affluent areas that turned out more. How surprising that. I mean, there's good points in that. People bemoaned a Glasgow turnout of 75%. 75%, because it was the lowest turnout in Scotland. The turnout in Glasgow in the 2011 elections was 41%. So, you know, huge changes. But, you know, the affluent areas, the middle class fear was more. And I think there was lots of kind of self-education and lots of great conversations. But we also have to put it in the point of, I mean, I think I even called it in this referendum, there was also a kind of pot noodle radicalism. You just add water and you can have your own alternative Scotland. So you'd get people saying to you in meetings, why can't we be Nordic? You're saying we can't be Nordic, but they're great, you know. And you're saying, well, it's 500 years of history. It'd be a long project to become Nordic. And so there was daft things being said. That's democracy. I think, you know, publics, the notion of what's public in Scotland shifted dramatically. And again, as it's my point, but the independence referendum being part of a long revolution and set of changes in Scottish society that aren't all about politics and certainly aren't all about the constitution. The Scottish Labour Party, I think it's kind of simple in a way, and I think it might be beyond it. It has to become a Scottish Labour Party. Because it's not. And so, you know, we're 15 years into devolution. There was a review after they got humped in 2011 by Jim Murphy and Sarah Boyack. And it only did a little bit of fiddling. So basically, the Scottish Labour Party to this day doesn't have a collective view on Trident or other issues that are reserved to the Westminster Parliament. It makes its view as individuals in the UK Labour process. This is kind of like torturous stuff. So it needs to become a kind of autonomous party. And I think it's, I mean, I think there's a huge set of caricatures with Jim Murphy. I mean, the word Blairite means nothing to 99% of Scots. You know, that's again a kind of like an echo chamber point, I think. And Murphy is making noise. He's being heard. Who was the last Scottish Labour leader who was heard? You know, none of the other ones. This is the seventh, you know, seven dwarfs. and you know, Donald Dewar wasn't a leader. Henry McLeish blew himself up. You know, then there was the Jack McConnell years. What was it? Do less, better. You know, that was memorable. Then Wendy Alexander blew herself up. And then there was Ian Gray. And, you know, it's not, if he's noticed, and even if he annoys people, I think in the short term, that's a start, because by annoying people, you get responses, and he's in a desperate catch-up to try and, like, you know, hold the line in on May the 7th, and then work out a strategy, because, you know, not surprisingly, he doesn't have a strategy at the moment. And your point about the working class is a huge one in the west of Scotland working class, because Labour, and I was a member of the Labour Party for 24 years, they stopped canvassing the west of Scotland working class vote. I don't know when. I mean, when I wrote the book on the Labour Party, we got them, for some reason they gave us access to archives, and there's reports in 1958 and 1959 saying we don't know what to do with these west of Scotland parties because they are dead. That's when this is supposedly, you know, a golden era, or the beginning of the golden era. So these are long, long-term problems, and I think the party actually, there never was a golden era with the trade unions, or the party's been a shell probably since the 30s, probably since the ILP broke away, and it became, the idea of it as a machine even, which some of us used to argue about, it wasn't really a proper machine like the SNP are, it was a metaphor of a machine, and now they don't have the machine, the life support of the trade unions, the local government, the patronage, and they're buggered.
can I just say something about that? Just something quickly about that. I take all the points that Adam and Jerry have made, but I mean, I think as Jerry's just said, the political culture of the Labour Party in the West of Scotland has always been quite passive.
Yeah, true.
And what the Labour Party has, which you can see in the discourse of the SNP and a lot of the pro-independence faction, is a brand. So the Labour Party has a kind of historical brand and mystique that is still quite powerful, and there's still a kind of emotional connection between that Labour brand and working class communities in Scotland. And where the Labour Party to kind of, the Scottish Labour Party to kind of get its act together at a kind of Scottish parliamentary level and project a decent message in the media, because they will then receive quite, as we've seen already with Jim Murphy, quite a favourable hearing from the media, I think there is certainly scope for the Scottish Labour Party to come back in that field. I don't think it's quite as dire as Adam portrayed.
Yeah, and I would call it undead, you see, it's not dead. Which actually, various Labour MPs say to you, oh, you mean we're not dead? That's really good news. but it's not alive either. And it's not a zombie party in that caricature, but somewhere in a twilight zone.
We're getting deeply metaphysical. I'm going to take a couple more questions. We've just got time for two more, and then we'll wrap things up. Yes, please.
I'm a DPhil student in Byzantine history, and I'm a member of the Green Party of England and Wales. But first, as a Byzantinist, I just have to question the idea that these sort of inevitable processes of the disintegration of an empire really means anything. I find that very problematic. But my actual question is that I really agree with what David said about how the economic argument is essentially a stereotype of itself. And we haven't really mentioned anything about, no one's mentioned oil. And I mean, the yes campaign seems to be impervious to facts. So no doubt the price of oil will soon become an opinion rather than a fact. But I'd like to know what the panel thinks, how this will actually affect the credibility, whether it will even touch the sides, or whether it will actually change this economic argument, which is just essentially talked about in stereotypes.
Okay, thanks very much. And last question.
Yes, my name's Pastor. I'm a postdoc at the Royal University. But for the purposes of this, I'm sitting here, Laura, as someone who's been a Londoner for the last 15 years, so I'm sitting here watching the referendum. Sorry. Been a Londoner for the last 15 years, sitting here watching the referendum play out, not filtered through national or basically London-based press. And I'm sort of wondering what spaces the aftermath of the referendum opens up in terms of exactly what we've been talking about in terms of narratives and the stories people tell about themselves for the general election, essentially. Because, yes, the end of January and May is not very far away. I should probably out myself as a Green Party member as well at this point.
I guess I should too then.
Well, before we all get hugged to screen, let's go to Jerry for a final word. Jerry, if you'd like to respond to these two questions.
Briefly, I think right, the point about the economy, right, you're absolutely right. As I said at the start, right, to my mind and to lots of people, the yes-no official offers were profoundly just flawed, you know, awful options. And there's this, as you said, there's this just central economic illiteracy in somebody that voted yes in the yes offer. And it was, you know, this rubbish about the 14th richest country in the world by GDP per head, you know, things that are meaningless to people. And then the problematic issues of the currency, the Treasury, the Bank of England, we can shift Scotland Scotland geopolitically into somewhere, you know, next to Norway, and yet at the same time, you know, the Treasury that's done all these things to, you know, the British economy, we will be governed and administered by. So profoundly problematic. What that sat in, I mean, it is a mixture of kind of all kind of like a collusion with neoliberalism by the SNP and Conservative, and also, I am sure, although someone would try and deny this, that yes, knew they were going to lose, or they knew in most scenarios they were going to lose. And so the position around the currency was one of, they knew if they had to invent a reserve bank, it became the question of where does capital come from, that government. So it's a position of maximising the number of votes while having a completely indefensible position, which is what people do in campaigns. And, you know, boy, you better watch what happens, because if they'd won, you know, we'd all been living with it, clearly. But I think as well, just the last quick point is, what that taps into, I think, is that the Scottish political discourse hasn't talked about the economy. Now, okay, there's the whole New Labour thing, they didn't talk about political economy, but Scottish politics has basically, until now, been about how you lobby to get better deals out of the Treasury, and so on. And that's been the Labour version, that's been how we've ended up with devolution, and indeed even the SNP play a lot of that. So we need to get back to talking about economy. And I don't know if we get that through fiscal autonomy. I don't know, you know, it probably, I think, takes independence for us to break that kind of problem mindset. And sorry, I've forgotten the question about, you said about...
It was interesting, what kind of space does the debates have been had in Scotland? Do they open up other spaces to think within the run-up to the general election? Do they have ramifications for
nationally? Well, see, the biggest thing I think that's happened is this thing about how there has been a DIY politics done in Scotland that I think, I don't know what Adam agrees, I think it's much, much more significant and far-reaching in Scottish society than, like, say, Occupy and so on. I mean, you know, for the last 20 years, various people, like, you know, myself and some pals, we went around practically as the oldest swingers in town, you know, all for 20 years being the youngest people at meetings, to the point it became a joke. And then suddenly, you know, there's this whole generation emerge that is just humbling, and there's all sorts of issues there about, there's a gender change, I mean, you know, which we've obviously, you know, I mean, pathetically, you know, reflected in the panel, and that change in permission. And I think I said it earlier, I think that's Scottish version of things that are true all across the West. People don't trust traditional politics, they don't trust politicians, they certainly don't trust what passes for social democratic parties. And how that finds a vehicle in England, you know, our UK, I mean, well, look at what happens with the Greens when people talk about them for a few days. People just don't trust traditional politics. And part of our referendum was, you know, well, the answer is yes, but, you know, we have all these other different versions of Scotland. The tension's in that. So, yes, but it's a long, long run. And I'd love to see kind of, you know, equivalents in England that aren't just kind of like, you know, the Greens or Occupy or so on. But you need, that's the point, you need an important question to hang it on that, but how do people feel they have collective power and they see it and feel it? That's what you don't have.
Thanks, Jay. Adam, please, last word from you.
So just on the question of the economy, I think that's quite right. What you got from both sides, yeah, was total nonsense economically, you know, and that's true in all of politics. You know, what politicians say about the economy is what will get you to vote for them based on economic rhetoric, not any kind of reality and any kind of genuine expression of an understanding of economics. And so I don't think there's any different in the referendum from any of what we'll get in the next few months for the general election, for example. And I think we'll have lots and lots of basically nonsense on the economy over the next 4 months from every side, you know, including people I'll vote for. And that's going to be, you know, that's just normal politics, I'm afraid. You know, it's not a good thing, but I don't think the referendum is any different in that sense. On the general election, I mean, it's worth just, you know, giving a sense of a couple of things in case you've missed them. It's, you know, on current polling, the SNP are going to get pretty much every seat in Scotland. I think they're probably quite right. They're probably going to get slightly fewer than every seat. And that probably means between, what, like 35 and 45 MPs going up from 6. And the way that will shape the whole nature of Westminster politics over the next 5 years, not just in any kind of discussion about who is or isn't Prime Minister, is important to think about, and the way that will shape the whole political discourse in Britain is, you know, is maybe there's a PhD in that too. And then I think it also, you know, the referendum did open up a huge space in English politics and, you know, politics across the UK. And, you know, I
I think Terry's right that the way that's been expressed in the last couple of weeks is that almost 20,000 people decided to go and join the Green Party all of a sudden. But I think that continues to bubble up, and there's this general sense, and I suppose that's why I started off by talking about those global processes of the post-2008 crisis and that context all over the world, and the decline of empire, except the point is not inevitable, but it's still declining for now. So the referendum, in a sense, was one of the touch paper we had here, in the same way as we've had other catalysts in other countries. And I think a lot of people, as Jerry sort of hinted at earlier, saw the British elite, the British states, who've become hated so much on the run in the referendum, and thought, this is fun. Let's have a bit more of this. and that, I think that dynamic will continue through the general election and beyond. And that's going to be interesting to watch.
Ben, last word for you.
So on the kind of economic argument, I mean, I suppose I would see it as much more of a problem for the advocates of independence than for the advocates of the status quo, because I think if you're advocating for an independent Scotland, you've really got to tell quite a credible story about how the economy is going to work and how it's going to affect people's living standards. And I think that was the weak point of the Yes case during the campaign, and that was where they were quite successfully attacked. Now, there was the particular issue of the currency, which was the centre of a lot of debates, and I've noticed in a lot of the kind of Yes nationalist discourse after the referendum, a lot of people are saying, well, next time there should be a case made for a separate Scottish currency rather than sharing the pound. But I suppose I'm doubtful that that's really going to solve the problem for the advocates of independence. I mean, Alex Salmond is a very clever politician, and he judged that it was not going to work to go into that referendum campaign advocating a separate Scottish currency. He thought it was much better to take the currency off the table and stick to the pound, because that was much more likely to ward off the kind of fears, the economic fears that might be associated with independence. And I think introducing a new currency into the mix only adds to those economic fears. And I think that is a big problem that advocates of independence will have to try and work out how to solve. And I don't really see a way around that dilemma. And then just finally on the disintegration of empire, which I think this is a very interesting point actually, and it somewhat goes against, I think, what Adam was saying, is I'm not sure the demise of the British Empire is that as close a connection to the rise of Scottish nationalism as you might think. I mean, if you think about the computerisation of it, Scottish nationalism really gets going properly in the 1970s, and a lot of the decolonisation has been kind of over by that point. Although there's a kind of rhetorical use of anti-imperialism in Scottish nationalism, and I would see the rise of Scottish nationalism as having a kind of socio-economic or material root, being based in kind of deindustrialisation, the rise of neoliberalism and so on, and being a reaction to that rather than being a kind of response to a sort of inevitable decline.
Quite a touch of Scotland as well.
Right, yes. Cultural elements.
Huge
important. Yeah.
Go on, 200.
I think that you can't look at the British economy and the rise of neoliberalism in Britain and the financialisation of Britain without looking at the fact that, we first had a trade deficit in the early 80s and basically have since then, which is largely, because we stopped plundering lots of other countries and having a trade surplus by stealing money from them, stealing piles of stuff from them. The decline of the empire in the 50s and 60s is what propped up our economy throughout the social democratic consensus and paid for a lot of that. And then, our failure to respond to that economically.
So, Adam, when a chairperson says you can either find a word, generally, we'll wrap up the debate.
Anyway, this is what I was going to
say. But with that helpful intervention, you came here this evening expecting some reflections on a recent event in Scottish politics. You've been treated to a cornucopia of discussion and debate from the demise of the Byzantine Empire through the Corn Laws to various other things. You got more than you bargained for, and now we're offering you a drink. Before we do that, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking all of our speakers.